you just don't go to brand A and buy model number B and pay C dollars and just plug it in. There's a little bit more involved to all of the alignment and the proper interfacing between transmitters, all of its filtering, the antenna, all of its time delay correction or group delay distortion correction. So I presume each installation has a degree of art and science and tweaking required to make it all play correctly. Is that approximately true, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I hate to burst your bubble, but you got to understand that technical people in broadcasting, let me turn this space shuttle down, it's making some noise here. Most of the technical people in broadcasting are becoming dinosaurs. And most of today's gear, I mean, there's like three main transmitter manufacturers and a couple of others. It's been all idiotized, you know. So the transmitter manufacturer comes, installs his transmitter, and then all you need to be is a button push. And if something really goes wrong, then you have to call somebody. But you got to understand also that with today's level of data processing, and because this is really a data transmitter, not an analog TV transmitter from that point of view, is that adjustments and all that stuff is done automatically by computers, which of course you can make work right or just let it make itself work well. K2IWK2DAC.
Yeah, as I used to say, anybody can make a mistake. To really screw up requires a computer. Okay. I wonder if Paul, WS2N, is there, and is there any further space information you can give us? One of the things that I was starting to mention last week is that when you do see the December issue of 2008 of Scientific American magazine on page 52, very nice article about the moon called Enceladus, which is going around Saturn, and the Cassini spacecraft has been investigating it. What's unique about that particular tiny little moon, which is one of the outer moons near the outer rings of Saturn, is that this little tiny moon out there, which is about 300 miles in diameter, should be a very cold object, and it's not. Yes, it's got a frozen water surface, but it's got water geysers that spit out a whole lot of organic compounds. So there's reason to believe that there is organic compounds in the fluid medium that's below the ice surface of this little moon called Enceladus. It might be one of the three candidate locations in our solar system that could have a biological life, which is kind of interesting. They're having great difficulty explaining where the heat is coming from that little satellite. In other words, because of its size, it should have cooled off a long time ago. There's not enough nuclear material on board to create excess heating, so they're not quite sure how it's staying as warm as it is. It's a hell of a lot warmer than it's supposed to be. Interesting article. Let's see if Paul is there. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Do we have a courtesy tone thing?
All you have to do is drop the carrier, don't worry, and do reset it once every minute or minute and a half, and go ahead with your space report. K2RIW, coming through very nicely.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that Enceladus. I think that might be the tidal effect, similar to what's going on to Io, between the poles of the different moons and especially the gravity of Jupiter. You know, well, Io has got a pretty eccentric orbit, so it's going to definitely have that kind of an effect. They know that, but I think that might be what's going on there, too. Have you heard that, Dick?
Without a doubt. Of all the speculations, there's various kinds of tidal effects and the coupling to the other moon. Enceladus is synchronous with a second moon where for every two orbits of one moon, one of them makes one orbit. And there's a towing going on between the two. Also, Saturn's out of ring is being created by all of the stuff that is being squirted out of these water geysers that are on Enceladus. So it is contributing to the empty ring, I think they call it, the outer ring. And the tidal effects do create some of the heating, but the early analysis of that says it's not quite enough to explain the temperature they're seeing right now. How back to you, Paul.
I've heard that as well, that it's contributing to the ring, but, I mean, that's not a complete explanation of where all these rings came from. They might be relatively new. You might come back millions of years from now, they might be gone, too. I've heard different reports like that. But we got to get a spacecraft out there. First of all, we've got to get one to, they've got to get the funding. They dropped one that they were going to send out there. Because of funding, but that's what you need. You need one to go into orbit around a different moon, then move on to another moon. That was on the drawing board. The same for Jupiter. Orbit different moons, then leave orbit and go to orbit other moons. In that system, think of the funding. I mean, the technology is there. I mean, they want to eventually land on Europa, for instance, and dig down through the ice, eventually put an underwater craft there. I mean, they know how to go about doing it. It's a matter of really funding to get something like that going. Look at the funding we have for the International Space Station. Now that thing is ready for doubling the occupants. You have three occupants now, and by 6 months from now, halfway through next year, they plan on having six people permanently on board that thing. Well, Endeavour came back today after 17 days visiting the ISS, did the four spacewalks, have repaired that gigantic rotary joint that was giving them problems, that they still had metal filings on. It stopped that from rotating. Now that's ready to go. That thing has to rotate one
repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Just in time, I hope. Okay, Dick, and the with the solar arrays up and running. Well, even without them, they have the ability to recharge that shuttle. That's why you're able to have an extended mission like that. Have the capability of running power from the cells to the not only the ISS but to the shuttle itself. It gives them an extra 3 days they wouldn't normally have, and it's the second longest visit to the space station by a shuttle. It did by about a day. And the last one was because of weather concerns. Waited an extra day before they came back and went into Florida. Weather wasn't too good down in Florida, so they landed out in California, on Edwardson. They have three main landing strips in the United States. Florida, Edwards Air Force Base out in California, and White Sands, New Mexico, which they used in the beginning. And they also used that a couple of years ago, too, for one landing. And they came back safe. They did four spacewalks, got the joint running. And that's some big joint. You know, the joint is as big as a Volkswagen. It's a huge thing to grease up and lube. And you might remember Heidi, lead astronaut for the spacewalk, bought the tools during the first EVA, floated away, had more on board, greased that whole thing up, and got that into operation. And they dropped off a couple of their bedrooms for more sleeping capability. Dropped off another bathroom facility, and then they have now it's a two bathroom house, rather, six bedrooms. So they've really changed and gotten it ready for complete occupancy. Originally it was supposed to be eight when they designed the ISS, but they're going to be having repeaters.
Timeout.
Able to get from the ISS into the space shuttle, if I understand correctly, You don't have to power up the fuel cells on the space shuttle anywhere near as much. You can almost power them back. Therefore, the consumables that run the fuel cell on the space shuttle are not being used, and I think that's part of the reason why you can extend the mission the extra 3 days. What's your guess as to how far they can push that? I mean, could they turn off the shuttle entirely and leave it attached to the International Space Station for a month? Is that possible? If, for instance, a repair mission was required of a leading-edge tile on the space shuttle? That's question number one. And question number two, how did they get rid of the metal chips that were in the grease of that rotary joint when they repacked that? Did they actually take it apart and clean it, do you think? Don't forget to reset every minute or so. And back to you, Paul. KQLIW.
I don't have enough details on how they went about doing that, getting rid of the filings that were there. I think they just wiped them clean. And then they had grease guns, one of which exploded. I mean, he had stuff all over, grease guns. So that was a problem. So what else they did up there? I know they got ready for the final solar panel set to go up, you know, part of the spacewalk. So it wasn't all just, you know, greasing up this one one joint. In fact, I think they did both joints. Go back and check on that. But the there's a lot of things that they have to do to get ready for the connection of this next solar set that goes up. You know, each solar set is where money bet cross up, and then these things unfurl, 140 feet long. Each share of one is 40 feet wide. Of course, there's two sets, so it's really like 80 feet wide. This thing's a monster. It's already like almost 300 feet from one end of the truss to the other. Which is the length of a football field. That's always a good reference that they use. It's also a good idea, you know, area-wise, because as much as the truss area is 300 feet long, you've got almost that distance from the front to the back of the space station. It's all different modules when we drop it. Got the Kaibo unit near the front attached to the Node 2. Kaibo unit took two shuttle missions to get that thing together, and that's not even completely together. There's another section that has to be brought up, third section. And that's the Japanese component. Got the Columbus module that was put up there a while back. That's another lab by European Space Agency, also attached to Node 2. Back from that, you've got the Destiny module, the West Lab. And then from back from that, you've got the Node 1. Node 1 connects to the main truss section, you know, in one direction. I guess the X axis, and then the Y axis continuing back. You have the functioning cargo block, the Zarya unit, the Russian component that was first put up there. Attached to that, behind that, you've got the Russian Vesna module, the living quarters, presently the location of the bathroom, I believe the first one as well. Behind that you have the Soyuz spacecraft, Progress ships dock in that area. Somewhere in the middle there you also have the Quest module. That's another section where you go into, change into your space suit, go for a spacewalk when you drive it. So, you know, you've got this whole configuration that's you again, like you're equal to the size of a football field. And it's pretty well built, that other solar set up there. You've got three solar sets that have been bought up. You've got a fourth one to go. That'll be pretty much complete. I'd like to see them, you know, at one time I heard they canceled the cupola. That's a lookout area that they attached to the space station. Get a couple of guys to go up there and look out 360 degrees instead of a couple of windows that they have now. That would be nice. The funding was being cut. I haven't heard anything about that lately, which I think is good, because you could go, you know, you could stand there and look at, you know, spaceships approaching and leaving, you know, Tiada Dune for docking. I think that would be a good thing. Not to mention, psychologically, you know, you go up there and look around and you've got nothing to do. It'd be one heck of a view, you know, going nuts. And back to you, Dick, WS2M.
The fourth set of solar cells they're putting up, Paul, are they approximately the same size as the others that are already there? Does that mean they're getting about a 25% increase? That sounds to me like they're going to have quite a bit of excess power. Does that mean a docked space shuttle will be able to dock for a longer period of time? And that new set of solar cells, are they going to be connected to that same rotary joint that just got repaired? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's the, there's one set there that's attached. You got your truss coming out, and you've got the rotary joint, and then you've got the first set of solar cells, and then now the second set. You've got the port side and the starboard side. I think this is the starboard. I think the starboard side that needs the completion. And as far as time, yeah, you could increase the time. You asked about a month, yeah, you could stay a month. They could power the shuttle down and, you know, down to zero almost, and just leave it up there for a month. That's part of the plan. You know, they do all kinds of measurements. They have 100-foot boom that goes out, you know, 50-foot boom, and send it to another 50-foot boom. And they have cameras and lasers, and they check everything. Well, you know, what do they do if they find something? Sure, they've gone through the process of making up some kind of repair kits, and most of the goo and glop, and try to steal something that's bad. But say it's really bad. There is in their schedule, always another shuttle, nearly ready to be launched as a rescue vehicle. You know, that you don't pull that out as bad as you all know. It might take you 2-3 weeks to have a launch, and that thing might be delayed a week. So you need that 1 month capability, I've read that they do have that capability to stay there. Consumables would start to get low. You know, you send 7 people up, you've got 3 up there, now you've got 10 people using up all the consumables that are up there. You know, they'd all have to cut back and go on a diet, but I understand that they would be able to hold out about a month. What's interesting is when they increase the crew, let me drop it. You know, you don't leave the shuttle up there forever, but they do leave the Soyuz spacecraft up there for 6 months at a time. You know, a crew comes up, and they dock, Russian crew. But when they go back with a different spacecraft. So they don't come back to the same spacecraft. They leave the other one up there as a rescue vehicle. You always have to have enough seats. A meteorite hits the thing. You can't abandon ship. You've got to be able to, or a fire or something, you've got to be able to get everybody off. So that means there's going to be 2 Soyuz spacecraft permanently docked. They like to leave them for 6 months or so and then bring them back. Can't escape in a progress ship. The progress ships look like the Soyuz ships, but they're cargo vehicles. That should be interesting. Won't be sending up shuttles after 2010. So you're going to have a crew of 6 with 2 Soyuz spacecraft always attached. Back to you, Dick.
On this last trip of, I think it was Endeavour, were there any paying guests on board? What's the total number of astronauts on the International Space Station now? And is there a plan to increase that number in the near future? Over to you, Paul.
Check in, Dick, and to we go.
Glad to hear from you, Rich. Go ahead, Paul.
Good evening, Rich. 3 on board now. 6 will be permanently manned roughly 6 months from now, mid-2009. That's what this flight was mainly about, besides repairing the starboard joint. So you've got a on board, 3 there permanently now. And what was the other question? There was something else, part B to that.
Yeah, do we have, Was there a paying guest during this last trip?
NASA has never launched a paying guest at all. Only on the Russian ships. NASA decided a long time ago that that was not going to happen, especially at, you know, after the Challenger explosion in 1986. Any thought of that, of the paying guest, was crossed off the list. But the Russians do it for $20 million now. You know, you pay them, and they'll train you in Star City for 6 months at their training facility. And they'll blast you up there for sometimes 7 days. The last guy that was up there, I think, was there 7 days. Some woman there before that, she was Iranian descent, but out of Texas. She did it for $20 million. First guy was this guy, Dennis Tito, out of California. Gave them $20 million. And another guy named Mark Shuttleworth. Sounds like a name that would go into space. Mark Shuttleworth. That was his name. He came out of South Africa. Some kind of an internet millionaire, billionaire, whatever it was. I think there's been a total of 6 people that have done that so far. Turned over $20 million to the Russians. Sometimes they'll send up 2 people. They want to send up 2 Russians. People Russia and America up to space station. Well, the Soyuz spacecraft holds 3 seats, so if they're doing that, they'll make room for another person and send them up and bring them back. Now, this time we dropped off Sandra, what's her last name? She's going to stay for 3 or 4 months to drop it. But she is an astronaut, and they brought back this other guy. He's been up there for 6 months. So there was a crew exchange on this flight. Went up with 7. They came back with 7, but not exactly the same 7 that went up. Back to you, Dick.
And wasn't one of the astronauts this time Owen Garriott's son, who's also a ham radio operator?
Oh, no, that was the last paying customer. He went up with the Russian group for 7 days, and he came back. He came back with the last Soyuz flight, landed in Kazakhstan. But yeah, if you go up with the Russians, you come back with the Russians. You're not coming back with in the space shuttle unless there's some kind of an emergency. NASA doesn't care. You know, it's a 16 country endeavor. They have 16 countries involved in the space station. So you know. If it was up to NASA, they wouldn't allow this. But if Russia wants to do it, they can do it.
And one last question I had. What the heck was it now? Huh. Question went out of my head. It's a number of astronauts, who, how long they stay. Oh, yes. If on a launch we had as much damage to the leading edge of the shuttle as we did on Columbia, where a whole leading edge tile has to be replaced, I think. I don't think you can put enough glue, so to speak, to repair a great big hole like they probably had on the leading edge of Columbia. And I don't think there's any spare part like that on board. So therefore, the very next shuttle coming up as a rescue mission would have to bring a leading edge tile to be replaced in space on the first shuttle that was damaged. But this is pure speculation on my part. To your knowledge, has there ever been a discussion of a repair scenario like the one I've just indicated? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
I heard the carbon problems on the leading edge in front of the shuttle. I heard that's not really repairable. Airline cracks, they got some kind of gooey here and there, but mainly for tile work, you know, tile replacements or balloon tiles together, maybe hairline cracks, but a big hole, I don't know. I don't know what they would do. My guess, they'll probably bring up some kind of a replacement part and try to do a couple of spacewalks, leave it attached to the space station, and the shuttle can come back unmanned. I would think that they would take this thing. Say, let's try to save it, a $2 billion piece of equipment, and we're going to take this thing and we're going to try to land this thing unmanned and try to save it. But I think pretty much toast. I don't think they would fix it and then fly anybody back in it. That's what I think. You also asked about extended missions. Before they used to go to the space station, they used to develop this system. Put it back in a cargo bay, you'd have a space hab, a gigantic room, taking up, say, almost half of the length of the cargo bay. And you'd have the astronauts in the front, and you'd have them go on to the back. I can't remember mentioning one time they launched as many as 11 people one time, one shot. And they needed extended missions for this. And behind this whole array of living quarters, you have the tube to float into, and you go to this sky hab, they call it. And basically a room. And they had all the lab in there and all, and working in a big room. Behind that, they had this giant power assembly, extra power that was being developed, extra fuel cells, as you will, powering the shuttle. And they would get 14, 15, 16, 17, 8.
Repeater, timeout. Timeout, cancel.
So, once again, are you telling me there was a mission which had 11 human beings on board the space shuttle? I'll run that by again, Paul?
Yeah, they did it a couple of times. It was in the 80s. I have to either go back, old books on all the different original flights. Of course, the internet would show you probably put in 11 crew members on STS and see what comes up. But they did a couple times. They had the red team and the blue team. I don't remember. Those were the days when they were so confident that they would launch without helmets on or anything. I mean, there's no spacesuits. Just blast them up there. It's interesting if you go back in the history of the space shuttle. And they had the red team would be awake doing a 12-hour shift, sleeping. No, just went on for days like that. And that's how they got all the science and everything done in the back of the space lab. Space habit. Space habitat or space lab. Whatever. I mean, they brought this thing up in the back of the shuttle many, many times. Yeah, it's interesting. I think that was the record, 11.
Impressive. Okay, Rich, N2EO, what's the latest with you? And Laura's a little concerned that you didn't sign in earlier. My guess is you slept through, your alarm clock didn't wake you at the beginning of the TechNet, and the jingles didn't wake you. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Limog, M2EO. Yeah, I spoke to Laura on the phone. She's sweet. She was worried about me. All right. I was taking, like you say, I was taking a nap, and then I had dinner, and one thing sort of blended into another. Dick, got a question. Earlier today, I was taking some readings on a radio. RF output was a bird meter. And I'm not seeing any output. I'm going bonkers here, wondering why I got no output. Turns out the element, the 400 to 1,000 megahertz 50-watt slug, apparently went bad because I put in a 100 to 250 megahertz just to see if I was going to get a reading. And I did get a very good reading. Those elements, I don't know, dropped it, or what goes wrong with them? I never had one go bad. And does Bird repair them? They used to be $55. I think they're $95 to hit now, Dick. Ed?
Yeah, the actual element is a equivalent of a 1N21 diode, a point contact diode. That's what really does all the work. And then after that, there is a kind of a filter network, because the pickup little loop in the inside of the slug is not as long as it should be to be a full quarter wavelength long directional coupler. It's much shorter. Therefore, it has a rising frequency response. At higher frequencies, it has greater response at 6 dB per octave of rise. So there's a filter network afterwards that rolls off at 6 dB per octave, to try to compensate for that. That's why each one of these slugs has a particular frequency range. You can use a slug that's pretty far out of the frequency range, and you'll get some pretty good action. The accuracy, of course, will degrade. And if you cared enough, there's ways that you could calibrate your slug out of its frequency range. You could take a slug that's made for 100 to 250 megs and use it on 250 to 500 and come up with your own frequency calibration if you wanted to. And that wouldn't be an unreasonable thing to do. The only slight disadvantage if you go up in frequency is that the directivity might not be right. Going down in frequency, there's a much higher probability it'll have good directivity. In other words, the forward and reverse won't be quite as clean. But if you're just using it for measuring power, I think you can do very well. It's just that the visual readings could be a little bit pessimistic. So quite possibly you open that diode. In my opinion, it's a repairable item, Rich. Whether or not Bird has a service that repairs them, I don't know. You're about to find that out. But if I owned a slug, and it turns out I do have a slug that has failed, and I've always said to myself, one of these days, I'm going to take it apart. And I don't think it would take rocket science to find out whether or not it's got a blown diode and replacing it. Your ohm meter would carefully use an ohm meter. You've got to be careful about electrostatic discharge. But a carefully used high-scale ohm meter, I think, could tell you what's going on inside. Because it's a fairly simple network. It's a pickup loop, a diode, an RC filter network, and output connectors that go to the meter. N2EO, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I guess we're not going to get a beep. All right, Dick. Well, I will call Bird Electronics during the week, so I'll fix it. It might not pay to put a technician on it because they're $95 for a new one. They used to be $45 to $55. I think they're now $95. The last slug I bought. But I will call them and find out. I know Bird is kind of funny. They didn't actually say it, but the impression I get is that they'd rather not sell to hams anymore. I forget what it was now. They did some distributorships are different. The last slug I bought, I know I had to buy it from a company. It wasn't Cellwave, but it was another company from the cellular industry. I was forced to go to one of these companies that deals with cellular to buy a Bird slug. So the next slug I needed, I bought from Coaxial Dynamics, that, you know, makes their own meter. It's a clone of the Bird. I wonder if you've ever used Coaxial Dynamics meter. It's supposed to be as good. And they do sell to hams. I understand, in talking to the people at RF Parts, that Coaxial Dynamics, there was a breakaway of a few engineers from Bird that started Coaxial Dynamics. Supposed to be every bit as good and interchangeable. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, I think there's a 50-50 chance you're going to find out that they don't repair them, that the value of a new one is not that different from the repair, in which case you're going to be stuck with the bad one, and therefore you're either going to send it to Barry or you're going to send it to Dick for doing a repair. That's a possible outcome there, Rich. Other than that, did you get the knobs you were looking for? Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, actually, I found a guy on the Internet. The Internet's wonderful for finding these parts. W9 Charlie Yankee. He sells Drake knobs. He's got the knobs. I sent him $30, which covers the knobs and shipping. PayPal, send money feature option. And the knobs will be coming this week. I found a lot of vintage parts just going online. Also ordering from, you know, more mundane parts from companies like Mouse of Electronics, or DigiKey, or Newark Electronics, Allied Electronics. These are the companies I deal with on the contemporary parts. I find it much easier rather than dealing with a person that might make a mistake in what I'm telling them on the phone. I put it in on the Internet. It just works out quicker and better. and they also ordered some tubes, tube sockets, antique stuff from Antique Electronic Supply, or Radio Days. I know Mel knows about Radio Days in Rochester, New York. Yeah,
the internet is pretty good on finding all kinds of information these days. I'm extremely pleased with everything that I find in Wikipedia. I'm amazed that there are so darn many schools, high schools and colleges, where the professors will tell the students they're not allowed to use Wikipedia as a resource, as a reference. And I find the information on Wikipedia extremely accurate. There may be a little bit of temporary bad information, but because it's being online peer-reviewed, it rapidly gets corrected. And what's left there is pretty darn good information, in my opinion. The crazy problem I got is a little bit similar to your knob problem. I don't know how I'm going to solve it. The oven-broiler combination that's in my house is built into a very customized cabinet. And the cabinets in 1957, when my house was built, were very narrow. The oven, I think, has an inner... a dimension, the hole in the wall that the oven plugs into, I think is something like 21 inches wide. A number like that. And all ovens these days are much, much wider. You can't buy an oven that's more narrow. And the ones that I could buy are very, very different style. What has failed on the oven is the thermostat knob or switch arrangement. In other words, the thing that turns the oven on to 350 degrees Fahrenheit or allows you to flip over to the broiler. That switch mechanism and that thermostat completely failed. Well Built was the brand name way back in 1957. Well Built went out of business probably 20 years ago. So you can't even buy parts for it. So I'm looking for some kind of a universal thermostat oven control. All it's got to do is turn on the oven element, which is already there, turn it on and off until the thermostat comes up to the right temperature, or allow me to switch over to the broiler. So I need some kind of a universal switching arrangement, and I'm willing to drill a hole in the front panel and mount the new one there. It's a lot easier than trying to find anything that will even come close to the right horizontal and vertical dimensions and fit this crazy piece of cabinetry, which would be very difficult to replace. So if anyone out there has a suggestion for a universal oven control, thermostat, and
repeater, timeout, cancel.
I have oven control and broiler control with a universal thermostat. I'm looking for it. I'm willing to pay money. Other than that, I'm going to give one more listen to see if anyone else has any questions. If not, Mel's going to open up his mailbag, and we're going to answer more than the normal number of questions tonight. Anyone else got any questions for the TechNet? Give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW listening.
Yeah, maybe I can help you with your oven.
Sounding good. Anyone with any further questions? Somebody say yes, but, and the signal was extremely noisy. I'm listening on the input, so maybe that's where I'll hear you. Give it another try.
WB2BXO.
Okay, Frank, WB2BXO. Quite noisy. You'll have to talk loud and go right ahead, Frank.
Okay. Just wondering.
Okay. UCC send by.
Go ahead, give it a go, Frank.
This is Ken. I was asking, last week I tried to listen to the net via the internet, via one of the live feeds, either W2LIE or WB2HWW, and neither of them seemed to be working. I was wondering, I haven't had a chance to text tonight, but I was wondering if anybody knew what was going on. Go ahead.
Yeah, Andy, WH2CDL, the technical maven for the repeater, signed in tonight saying that the internet link is down at the site, and they're still repairing it. It was down last week, and it's down this week also, Frank. That's why you're not hearing it. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Very good. I thought he was only talking about the link to one of the other repeaters. I didn't realize he was talking about the okay, very good. Thanks a lot. I'll be listening off and on for a while yet. WB2BXO.
Yeah, the internet link is down, and I think they're using the internet as the linking between the eastern input and the western input. so I think it's a combined function there. Looks like it's time to go to the mailbag, Mel. And I know we were into joules and watts and newton meters and BTUs. And we got into all kinds of things last week. I'll bet you got quite a bit of mail. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. First of all, let me help you with your oven, over.
Yeah, I wish somebody made a universal timing control mechanism so I could just drill a hole in the front panel and install it. Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, what you gotta do, there are places around that sell appliance parts. And I know you look on the internet and all, you're not gonna find it. But if you walk in there with the parts, one of these people, they got people in there that know everything about appliances, and I had that experience. I walked in from an old piece of equipment, an old stove also, and couldn't get the control assembly also. And I walked in with that, and I told him what the situation. He says, well, we got one that works the same way, as long as you can, want to do a little bit of maneuvering to get it in. And they have these guys, they know over-the-counter what you want, but you got to show them, take over.
I've done that twice, Mel. Twice I took the old part to two different places that sell parts. I think one of them was called Standard Parts or All Appliance Parts. And a pretty big outfit, and they got a lot of stuff in their catalog. But because the particular brand name on mine was discontinued more than 20 years ago, they were unwilling to say that, hey, this is close enough and it'll do. Maybe your guys in Brooklyn are much more friendly, but out here in Suffolk County, even with the part in hand, they would not volunteer to offer me one that might be a substitute. So maybe I'm going to have to go to one of your Brooklyn places, Mel. Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, there's a few of them around here. Pretty good. One on Coney Island Avenue. Allmakes, I think he calls himself. Allmakes Part. Big place, and they got all kinds of stuff in there, wildest things that I can say. There's a number of places here in Brooklyn that may help you, Dick. I could get the name. I have a friend that, in fact, that's what he does. He plays appliances, washing machines, dryers, dishwashers, and all that kind of stuff. So he's always getting situations like that, and he says he seems to always be able to find something that'll work. Over.
Thomas, Dick. Okay, I'm going to take you up on that. Who just said something, Dick?
Yeah, N2GUK, Dick. There's a place on Merrick Road in Seaford, Universal. They have all the, typically have components, heating elements, and so on for the ovens and all kinds of appliances. You might try them.
Okay, GUK. Melville Road, I think you said, in Seaford. And the place is called Universal or Universal Park, something like that.
No, that's, I think it's, I'm pretty sure it's Merrick Avenue. Merrick Avenue in Seaford. It's on a big stretch there. Because we put a couple of elements for the, they call it the Martha Washington oven. The thing is, as old as our house in Levittown, so this thing here has got to be, or was, replaced it. Had to be a good 40, 50 years old. You might think of those lines. Universal Parts. They even advertise on TV. They advertise about the gas ranges and gas conversions and so on, relative to kinds of heating headaches and stuff like that. So that's Universal, Merrick Road, and Seaford.
Very fine, Rich. I thank you. Okay, I'll give them a try. And my guess is these places are open from 8 in the morning until 5 at night. Is that what you would say, Rich?
Oh, yeah. I think they're very helpful. They've helped us with a couple of different problems we had with washing machines, dryers, you name it. They have all kinds of components. They have them in stock, which is the best. You just go down there and you pick them up. Little rollers, they go in little trays for the dishwasher. I mean, you name it, they have it. So that would be something of interest. Well, anyway, it might solve your whole problem. I wanted to ask you a question, but I think you're going into the mailbag, so it might be too late to ask you a question.
You've been so darn helpful. We're gonna break out right now and answer your question, Rich. Go right ahead. And by the way, I'm still a little bit worried because these guys will keep old parts, but when it comes to a non-Cadillac brand, Well Built is the brand name that did exist in 1957. They're more than 20 years out of business, and so getting parts for that old clunker is going to be hard, even though you think they've got Martha Washington's up in there. Go ahead, Rich, with your question.
I couldn't believe they had the part. I bought two elements because evidently if you put aluminum foil on the bottom of your oven, it tends to overheat the elements in. It might be good for a couple of years, maybe a year or so. So we ruined one that way. We knew not to do it the second time. But the second element went also, I guess, due to whatever, you know, wear and tear and stuff. But they did have the elements. I could have got a third element and said, you know something? Let me get a new oven. That's a better idea. The new oven's beautiful. So that, you know, it fit right in the spot where the old oven was. And I think the dimensions that you mentioned are similar to our dimensions in our oven space, where our oven is right now. In fact, we bought the new oven, and got it at a very good price, by the way, in Jay's in Levittown. You might think about that also. But I would try to put a part first, you know, if you know, the oven is a decent oven stuff. I say, we put a little bit of work into ours. Anyway, problem we have is converting over from oil to gas. Now, the problem is that gas does not come into our house or at the street level where we live, but there is gas on the corner. And I think they quoted us a price of $78 per foot, which is astronomical, ridiculous, but naturally, you know, cost of man hours and parts. But I'm curious if anybody knows a way of getting around this, maybe call a townspeople, one of the people out there that could help us out with getting gas to our particular part of the block. In fact, even further, because there's people on our block who also want the gas to come into their houses. But we have, I think, about 100 feet or so. They wanted to charge us something in the order of like $6,000, which to me, with these taxes, we got to pay that kind of money? That's crazy. But anyway, maybe you have some kind of idea, Dick. K2RWNTGUK.
Before you convert, you may know that on two occasions, maybe three occasions, we had a whole hour or two session about how to get a hell of a lot more performance out of the oil burner. Irwin, W2, can't think of Irwin's cold letters all of a sudden, Irwin Dresner, a Limog member from way back, had a contract from Brookhaven Laboratory to investigate the status, the tuning arrangement, so to speak, of oil burners on quite a number of homes on Long Island, and the high percentage of them were being misset. The person who sells you oil, the person who cleans your burner, and the person who sets your controls are all the same person, and that's a conflict of interest. If he's keeping this set for controls a certain way, you burn more oil, you buy more oil from him, and he makes more profit. So we've been through a number of sessions where many oil burners are terrifically misset. So are you sure you want to bail out on your oil burner? I am convinced that throughout most portions of history, and I bet it's true now, if you calculate BTUs per dollar, the real amount of heating you get per dollar of fuel, it is my belief that you're going to get more heat per dollar out of fuel oil. And so have you already done the conversion? I think the answer is no, because you don't have a gas line. And so are you sure you really have to? That's my first question there, Rich. Go ahead.
USK.
Okay, you have a QFK up there, Dick. Do you want to pick him up?
Mr. QSK, have you got something to contribute on this particular subject?
Negative. You got KB2UCT here. This radio, I just dug it out from the closet. I was wondering if it was still working, because the battery is really bad. No, as far as the subject, no input on that. Thank you.
Yeah, that radio is working pretty good, Mr. UCT. No problem. Sounds good. You're in the middle of the technical net right now, and so we take questions from the floor and answer them. So, Rich, go ahead with your answer on have you done the conversion, and you sure you have to bail out on that oil burner? I'll bet you there are ways that we can teach you to get at least 20% more performance out of it. Over to you, Rich.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Well, I'll tell you, when we first moved in about 20 years ago or so, the first thing we'd done was change the burner itself. know, to a high speed and all that kind of good stuff pregnant. My brother-in-law was in the business, meaning say he helped me do all the conversions and stuff like that as far as putting in a better burner. And actually, I'll tell you, it definitely worked better. It definitely gave us a little, you know, a bit better economy or fuel economy, however you want to look at it. But still in the world, oil, I think the last time, well, not this past, which was about a month ago, but the prior month, we paid something in the order of like $4 a gallon. Well, anyway, the oil delivery cost us $777. I actually played that number. But I can't see paying these oil prices. As far as the burner's concerned, the burner, I tell you, it's one of those old cast iron, it's the original with the house, which I from what I hear, very efficient, holds the heat, you know, just doesn't go out like gas does. By the way, I did listen to your little seminar, which was very interesting. I wanted to jump in there at the time and make some comments, but I took it all in, you know, as far as efficiency and the flu and metering and so on. Because I had, actually between my brother-in-law and two other friends, we had one fellow check it with the equipment there, you know, for efficiency, and I think it was up around 80 to 90% efficiency, you know, efficient and so on. So the burns well. I mean, it gives us a good, I'd say typically 6 weeks in the cold weather, and the freezing weather, like we're kind of having, maybe 4 to 5 weeks. So we do quite well with typically around 200 gallons, 220 around here somewhere. So as far as being efficient, I'm not lacking in that department, but I'm very happy about the fuel prices. And everybody tells me that they're paying less than half the gas. Now, I heard Bell mention what, you know, what kind of prices he's paying in Brooklyn. And I know Brooklyn, they charge astronomical numbers for gas. Let me let go. Okay. And out here, gas, I think, is cheaper, as far as I know. But from what I hear, most people are paying half the price I pay, and that doesn't make any sense at all. So I'm automatically going, you know, and I'll tell you how I really feel about it, Dick, is that, you know, with what's going on with the political situations out here with our country and so on, I wouldn't mind paying more for gas, to be truthful with you. Because to give them a penny, that's too much. But anyway, my whole thing is this gas line. Definitely converting over to the gas heat, and hopefully it's working out. The one thing I was interested in also was the non-flue type burner. It doesn't even flue. It recycles the heat, or the gases, and so on. I know you mentioned the name. I also got it from Luco. They gave me some names and stuff like that. They do have specials. So with that, our main problem is the gas line.
Okay, I just got an oil delivery on, let's see, what date was this? That can't be the right date. Must be November 17th. And I paid $2.19 a gallon. No, $2.22 a gallon. I buy it on the spot market. I'm not doing it with a contract. I think the contract is not the right way to go. Oil used to be $150 a barrel when it was being sold raw. It's now down to $50 a barrel. So the price of oil is dropping pretty fast. If you go to a spot dealer and in the Penny Saver and many other places, there's a whole lot of places you can go to that will quote you what is the price of the day. And as long as you pay cash and buy more than 200 gallons, you get that price. So oil is dropping. Gasoline is dropping. And as I said, the $4 per gallon you paid a month or two ago is now down to $2 and some odd cents, $2.10, something like that is the price right now, and it's going to continue to drop, in my opinion. You may think that gas is half the price. If you actually do the calculation, and it's a difficult calculation, difficult because they sell it to you in different units. You're buying cubic feet of gas and paying some number of dollars per thousand cubic feet, and oil you buy by the gallon. So figuring out the real amount of heat you get out of the fuel versus the dollars you pay. It's going to take you a half hour of figuring in order to do the comparison. But the people who sell gas, they keep right up with the price of oil. You may think it's half the price. It is not. On top of that, you probably have a retention head burner. It's a modern kind of a oil burner. And if it's got the right size nozzle, you don't have to put up with a rumbling sound. You don't have to put up with black soot and so on. An awful lot of oil burners are misset, and people are putting up with noise and soot and all kinds, and inefficiency. So I'm not convinced you should bail out on oil yet, is one possible opinion. You just consider that. Before you do switch over to the gas, find out what is the price of the oil per gallon on that particular day, and it's continuously dropping. And then try to calculate what is the amount of heat you get per...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What's the amount of heat you get for the same number of dollars with the gas? And I think you're going to discover that gas is not cheaper. And although it's a rare event, once per couple of months, I still keep hearing about gas explosions that make me unhappy. And that doesn't happen with oil, so go slow on that next move. It's going to cost you a few thousand dollars to make the move to establish the gas line. I don't think you're going to find a way of getting that gas line in for free. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think you're going to. And sometimes the gas companies will give you the equipment for free, but that's if you sign a great big contract with them. And I'm not sure you want to go down that route, down that road. Over to you, Rich. Into GUK, KQLIW.
WS2N with a correction.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, not 11. 8. 8 is the number. 1985. 8 is the number. Plus two people on the air. On the Mir spacecraft, you might come up with 11. But 8 is the maximum number that they launched. A couple of times they went up with 7 and came back with 8. You know, they brought somebody back from a mission. So I just went through all the papers here. That's the maximum. They have plans of eventually sending more per flight. But this was the flight first. This was Challenger. The next Challenger mission after that exploded, so they kind of canceled that. But it was a space lab mission. Back to you.
Very good, Paul. Thank you. So back to you, Rich. W2GUK, KQLIW.
Okay, thank you for the upgrade. NTGUK. Oh, I'll tell you, we buy them, I guess they say bulk or cash. We do our own servicing also. And really, as far as efficiency is concerned, again, they seem to be fine. But I just keep on hearing people say they're paying a lot less than me. Actually, our last delivery was, I guess, about a month ago or so. I think we paid $2.67 a gallon, something around there. It might have been cheaper, Tate, because I don't have the paperwork out right this minute. A lot of people pay close to what you're measuring. But we go through like 10 different companies to find the cheapest, and then we call them and they come and whatever. But at the beginning of the summer, or actually ending the winter, that's when we had to pay, I think, around $4 a gallon, which came out to $7. And at that point, there, he said, I got to be crazy to keep on doing this. But that lasted the whole summer. And partially, I think it lasted until September or October. And then I think in November we had to get a delivery. That's what it comes down to. But I tell you, the more I look, the more I get numbers that we're paying a lot more than everybody else is paying. And you know what the next thing also is that this burner was the original, not the burner, but the boiler is the original one that came with the house. So it's 50 some odd years old and it's got to be replaced, you know.